Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The FBI's top brass lined up in Washington this morning to celebrate the Bureau's 100th anniversary. This is history that's the stuff of legend and white-hot controversy. G-men on the tail of machine gun-toting bank robbers, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI as Red Scare Snoop, assassination years, and a missed and epic terrorist attack. Now, post 9/11, the FBI has a lot on its plate, maybe too much. This hour, On Point, the FBI at 100, history and the way ahead. We're going to talk today with a big-time FBI insider and outsider and a reporter looking at its work right now. First, Mr. Outside, way outside. Joining me now from Edinburgh, Scotland, is Rhodri Jeffrey Jones, professor of American history at the University of Edinburgh. He's an expert on American intelligence and law enforcement. Professor Jeffrey Jones' latest book is The FBI, A History. Professor, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
We're going to ask you to do something almost impossible in the next 10 minutes, but kind of take us through the arc of this century of the FBI's existence. You've tried to describe its sort of focus and changing complexion, the things that moved it, and you tell us right off the bat that as you see it, it's really more than a century in the making.
Well, that's right, Tom. I think we can take the origins of the FBI right back to 1871. The Justice Department had been established in 1870, and there was a serious problem in the American South with the Ku Klux Klan, which was trying to deprive the newly liberated African-Americans of their liberties.
And that's putting it mildly, chasing and whipping and beating and hanging.
Well, that's right. The Ku Klux Klan was rampant in 1870, 1871. Mm. And so what the Attorney General, Mr. Ackerman, did at that point was to hire the whole of the Secret Service, which was an organization run by the Treasury Department, and put these detectives onto the job of chasing down Klansmen in the South, which they did very effectively with the help of courageous people, white as well as black, in South Carolina and other areas affected by this terrorist organization.
You call this the noble root, the noble beginning of the FBI. What's the 100-year mark that's celebrated by the FBI formally as its beginning in 1908 then?
Well, I think that this was noble in its way as well, and certainly something that people can look back on with pride, especially within the Bureau itself. What happened then was that Theodore Roosevelt, one of America's greatest presidents, decided that it was no longer sufficient to hire special agents from the Treasury Department, and the Justice Department had to set up its own force of agents, which soon became known as the Bureau of Investigation. Mm. And after 1935, that became known as the FBI. I think one of the interesting things here is that both the 1871 episode and the 1908 setting up of the Federal Detective Force are manifestations of a progressive trend in American history.
You described Teddy Roosevelt as getting in here to try and deal with the worst of the sort of Gilded Age robber baron influence. He feared that he had a bought and paid for millionaire Congress, that capitalism might topple over if he didn't get some tough law enforcement in there to make sure that it was clean and on the up and up.
Well, that's right. This was the approach to capitalism, which is that you're in favor of capitalism, but it's got to clean up its act. And that's necessary to the survival of the capitalist system. And that's exactly what Roosevelt did. He used federal agents. He hired them from the Treasury Department, and he used them to chase down people who were operating in restraint of trade and the great trusts, price fixing. And most famously, as a great conservationist, he chased down some timber barons in the West who were acquiring publicly owned forests in a corrupt manner. And this resulted in the prosecution of Senator John Mitchell and Congressman John Williamson from the state of Oregon. And this is why President Roosevelt deemed it necessary to set up a new agency, because Congress was starving funds from the Treasury Department and disabling it in its investigation of members of Congress.
Because they didn't want themselves to be investigated.
They didn't want themselves to be investigated, no. I'm giving you a particular slant in this because in the past people have felt that there was a threat to civil liberties and to the rights of congressmen right from the very beginning in 1907. My reading of it is the president was right in this case.
I want to get to Cops and Robbers, this sort of Bonnie and Clyde Dillinger era, but we can't help noting that race, though it was there in those origins, post-Civil War, it also became a problematic piece early on. 1910, the Mann Act, the White Slavery Act, and the White Slave Traffic Act, more specifically, and the FBI focusing very quickly on African Americans with a special vigor.
This is true. The FBI applied the Mann Act, or enforced the Mann Act in an unequal fashion, and most famously they chased after someone who was probably the greatest heavyweight boxer in history, Jack Johnson, who happened to be a black man, and whose transgressions included dating white women across state lines, and also whipping every white boxer who got into the ring with him. So that sets the FBI off on a racially biased trail, and I would argue it departed from its noble tradition by doing this.
Now, I know we're pushing you at light speed, but we'll circle back to this. I wish you'd gun forward to the 1930s and the sort of the Dillinger, Bonnie and Clyde era. When did the FBI become sort of national, most wanted, go after, always get their man, G-Man organization?
Well, I think this starts with the advent of Franklin D. Roosevelt to the presidency. And at that time, Al Capone and others who you mentioned in this program, Dillinger, were regarded as kind of Robin Hood people who robbed the rich in order to give money to the poor. I mean, they missed out the last bit. They just kept the money themselves. But they were getting a good press, Hollywood movies coming about them and so on. And Roosevelt and his Attorney General Cummings decided to do something about this and put the FBI on a crime-busting trail, got them better publicity in Hollywood and so forth. And up until then, the FBI had been rather a peaceful organization. For example, J. Edgar Hoover, who was the director, was very much against special agents carrying guns. Mm. He was a supporter of restrictions on the ownership of guns in the United States as a whole. But once given this new mandate by the federal government, he became someone who organized the G-Men, you know, as in G-Men,
government
G-Men,
men.
G-Men, don't shoot.
You know? Right, right. They chased down, hunted down Bonnie and Clyde. They gunned down, literally, John Dillinger. They went after Al Capone. But at the same time in the 1930s, there was a kind of politicizing going on, as you describe it. And in the first instance, it was from the kind of liberal quarter, from FDR's corner.
Yes, this is one of the ironies of the history of that period. We think of FDR as being a liberal or even a left-wing president, but his critics argue that he was responsible for setting up what's called the National Security State, and the FBI was a part of that apparatus.
This is in the run-up to World War II, and he was particularly concerned about keeping track of people who were not in favor of going to war.
Well, that's right. He was... FDR was keen to keep the criticism of his internationalist policy at bay, and asked the FBI to keep track of these people, for example, to find out if they had any foreign connections with Germany and so forth, and generally try to discredit his critics politically. Now, this is a difficult one to handle because most people think of FDR as a great hero who took on Hitler. But it's a question of the means used.
And, of course, then there's the great split after World War II, 1947, domestic and foreign intelligence and security divided between the FBI and CIA. We'll come back and look at a lot more, but you point to that split and to what you call a kind of xenophobia in the FBI as maybe the two major themes that could have come together, sadly, to get in the way of the FBI warning us off the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, I think that in my view, the division between the FBI and the CIA in 1947 was a mistake. It stemmed from President Truman's view that the FBI was too powerful, J. Edgar Hoover in particular, and he was convinced that the FBI was not only xenophobic but racist. The outcome of this was the CIA was given the foreign remit, the FBI the domestic remit. But unfortunately, when it comes to counter-espionage and counter-terrorism, you need a degree of cooperation. And that wasn't forthcoming between the CIA and the FBI. A lot of emphasis has been placed on the personality of Hoover, but in fact that rivalry persisted after the death of Hoover, and I view it as an institutional weakness, which certainly contributed to the non-joining up of the dots in the weeks preceding 9/11.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the FBI at 100, from Dillinger and G-Men and J. Edgar Hoover to the War on Terror. We've been joined by Professor Rhodri Jeffries-Jones, Professor of American History at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, author of The FBI, A History, looking at the big arc of this very important and dramatic bureau's life through that century. We'll be joined in a moment by the man who was J. Edgar Hoover's right-hand man, but let's get a little bit of that sound in our ear. J. Edgar Hoover, of course, joined the Department of Justice in 1917, directed the Bureau from 1924 until his death in 1972. That is a long time. Here he is in 1937, protesting the leniency of parole boards in perpetrating what he called the wholesale opening of cell doors. You can hear the FBI message here as he reminded parolees, "We always get our man."
We must not for a moment lose sight of our goal, to teach the criminal that regardless of his subterfuges, his squirming, his twisting and slimy wriggling, he cannot escape the one inexorable rule of law enforcement: you can't get away with it.
No use trying that twisting and slimy wriggling, said J. Edgar Hoover. Of course, always a big public fascination with the FBI, especially in the middle of the 20th century. Here in 1965... television network ABC launched a new TV series called The FBI, making the actor Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. a household name across the country. Here's Zimbalist in promoting the launch of the new series.
I'm Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., and this is the firing range of the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia. This fall, during ABC's premiere week, you'll witness an important first in television, the premiere of an outstanding new dramatic series called The FBI. In the series, I play Inspector Lou Erskine, and as you may have gathered, that's why I'm here. In order to ensure that every episode be completely authentic, I'm going through the same course of training given to every special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
ABC's series The FBI, being promoted in 1965. Rhodri Jeffries-Jones joins us from Edinburgh, Scotland, and right now from Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. We're joined by Kartha D. Deloach, former deputy director of the FBI from 1965 to 1970. He joined the FBI in 1942 and served over 28 years before retiring in 70. He was number two at the agency, J. Edgar Hoover's right-hand man, responsible for public relations in an agency always very attuned to that, and at times a whole lot more. Kartha D. Deloach, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Hello, Tom.
It's great to have you. You've got that FBI voice right out of the gate, sir. You must have been great on radio.
Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed several programs over the years, and so have many other agents.
Tell us about what it was like to work at the right hand of J. Edgar Hoover. Before he left office, he had a pretty dark reputation in much of this country for all kinds of reasons. But you were right there at his side and often speaking for him and the Bureau. What was that experience like?
Well, I think it was a very good experience. It was a very trying experience at many times, but Mr. Hoover had much tenacity and brilliance, and before I go further, let me correct the record by stating that you call me the right-hand man. I was the number three man in the FBI. Clyde Tolson was the associate director, but I was in charge of the four investigative divisions, and I had four assistant directors reporting to me in that capacity. But Mr. Hoover was a strong, deeply religious, hard-driving individual who never gave up those traits. Perhaps he stayed on maybe perhaps a little too long, but nevertheless, during his time in office, he proved time and time again his brilliance and his great handling of matters, including being probably the best toe dancer in Washington, because he had to insofar as political complexities are concerned. But he created a solid structure of success brought about by such things as the centralization of fingerprints, the FBI laboratory, the National Academy, the National Crime Information Center, and many other accomplishments which gave law enforcement and, you know, also the general public vast advances in protecting the American public and our allies.
Mm. Mr. DeLoach, you were on the inside, number three there, very much at Hoover's side. During those years that you and he were both there, what would you describe as your most successful, proud moments, cases or otherwise, and what would you describe as low points looking back?
Tom, the most successful cases which proved, again, the excellent training of the FBI and its very excellent cooperation from general law enforcement, but the John F. Kennedy assassination, the case of the missing or murdered three civil rights workers down in Mississippi.
Philadelphia, Mississippi. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I was there on many occasions while that case was going on. The Dr. Martin Luther King assassination case, which concerned a bumbling but cunning criminal. And also I must throw in the Barbara Mackel kidnapping case where the FBI was fighting against time to save a life and finally found the victim buried 3 feet underground in a coffin during her last moments of oxygen coming in. So those four instances of cases probably were some of the toughest that I've seen. There were many thousands of others, but nevertheless, these represent probably the toughest.
Our guest, Roderick Jeffries Jones, who's listening and speaking with us from Edinburgh, points to a problem over time in the FBI with race. J. Edgar Hoover is widely understood to have kind of hounded Martin Luther King at the height of his career, tracking him, making tapes of him, and all the rest. What about the issues of race and the Bureau's treatment of the great civil rights leader?
The assumption there that he was hounded is absolutely false. As one college professor has put it in the United States, the FBI would have been greatly amiss in its activities as investigative authority and jurisdiction if it had not investigated Dr. King to some extent.
Why is that?
Marshall, the Assistant Attorney General under Bobby Kennedy, head of the Civil Rights Division, the Department of Justice, indicated that the FBI wanted to find out the extent of invasion of communism into Dr. King's movement, so to present the Attorney General all of the facts concerning the matter. But there was no hounding. We had jurisdiction, and so far as the matter was concerned, and trying to protect the American public at that particular time. Communism was very popular. There is no doubt but what Dr. King was a champion of his people and a badly needed asset in society. He was needed. His effects were very, very excellently felt and promoted good reasoning later on. But there were certain elements who tried to infiltrate his activities in order to control him. As a result, the FBI felt it necessary, with the knowledge of the Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy, to go into to investigate certain of those activities to find out the extent of infiltration. That's what caused it, and it was no animosity whatsoever from a personal standpoint.
Let's listen just a moment to get the backdrop here to feel J. Edgar Hoover's view of communism. This is some undated testimony, but you can kind of hear the period in it. Hoover testifying before Congress on the threat posed, he said, to America by American communists.
The Communist Party of the United States is a fifth column, if there ever was one. It is far better organized than were the Nazis in occupied countries prior to their capitulation. They are seeking to weaken America, just as they did in their era of obstruction when they were aligned with the Nazis. Their goal is the overthrow of our government. There is no doubt as to where a real communist loyalty rests. Their allegiance is to Russia, not the United States.
J. Edgar Hoover testifying there before Congress. Kartha D. DeLoach, who was number three at the Bureau under Hoover, is with us from Hilton Head, South Carolina. And from Edinburgh, Scotland, Roderick Jeffries Jones from the University of Edinburgh. Professor Jeffries Jones, what about, you describe a split in the American public's view of the FBI that came in the 40s, 50s, into the 60s, a very important split. And it was in part over this focus on pursuing communists, and it was in no small part over the FBI's treatment of Martin Luther King. I wonder what you think of the impact of the 50s and 60s sort of communist hunting era, and what about the FBI and Martin Luther King?
Yeah, I think that's the there was a shifting in public opinion on the FBI. Up until the 1940s, I think you could say that people you might describe as liberals saw the FBI as their agency. But from the 1950s on, it became the darling agency of people with more conservative opinions. On the subject of race, I think that Mr. Deloach puts his finger on it when he says that Mr. Hoover was driven by concern about communism rather than by a generalized prejudice against black people. I think that one of the misconceptions about Hoover is that he was a Southerner who shared the prejudice ascribed to his fellow Southerners against black people. He's accused of not hiring black special agents. In fact, he did hire in the 1930s and 1940s 15 black agents, and they weren't all chauffeurs. And I think the question is, were other government agencies more progressive than he was in this regard? And I think the onus of proof is really on the critics of J. Edgar Hoover to show that. On the other hand, I think it could be said that he, like other people in powerful positions in American life at the time, developed an obsession with the domestic threats of communism. And he tended to mistake a genuine and indigenous civil rights agitation in the United States. He tended to confuse that with a communist attack on the United States. And I think that was a very serious error.
Carter Deloach, of course, there was the famous or infamous mailing of tapes of Dr. King, tapes made of extramarital sexual encounters that went to the Southern Leadership Council and to Coretta Scott King, tapes apparently made and sent by the FBI. You've called that the worst thing that could have been done. What happened there?
I recall it very vividly, and it was probably one of the worst things that could be done insofar as public frenzy and attitudes concerned at that particular time regarding the so-called feud between Dr. King and Mr. Hoover. But Mr. Hoover knew nothing about the mailing of those tapes. We have proof of that. We know that. Clyde Tolson knew nothing about the mailing of those tapes. I knew nothing about them. But one of the four assistant directors of the investigative division, domestic intelligence division, W.C. Sullivan, was the one that caused a former section chief to fly to Miami, a fellow by the name of Lish Whitson, and mail those tapes and a note that Sullivan wrote personally and attached to the tapes. Whitson mailed them to Mrs. King, and they read them they listened to them accordingly. But I want to tell you once again, Mr. Hoover knew nothing about it. Tolson knew nothing about it. I didn't. Sullivan, later on, who was dismissed from the Bureau, not dismissed, but he retired from the Bureau under force, was the one that did that. And Mr. Hoover was very, very upset and very angry about it, as was Tolson and I. Mm.
Of course, those same tapes, Mr. Deloach, later kind of shopped around to news organizations. Ben Bradley said that they, as I read it, that they came from the FBI.
That is absolutely false. There's no truth to that whatsoever. They were not shopped around. But I've heard that before, but there's no truth or authentic facts whatsoever to back that up.
Bradley says that you yourself approached him with these tapes, and he's said that on the record and sticks with it.
Bradley did call me from time to time to ask me if we had anything in our files concerning certain secretaries or individuals he wanted to hire. But under no circumstances did I offer to show him or let him listen to any tapes. I never had the tapes in my possession to begin with. They were always kept in a vault by W.C. Sullivan in the Domestic Intelligence Division. I did not want to listen to those tapes. They were somewhat sickening. But nevertheless, the accusation against my wanting to show those or let journalistic people listen to them is absolutely false.
Of course, Ben Bradley recounts that differently, and he says, I don't think there's any doubt about it, and I don't make things up, he says. Let's turn to our listeners, if we may. From Harvard, Massachusetts, Marty's calling. Hi, Marty. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to ask the professor whether he thinks there was a quantitative or qualitative change in the kind of xenophobia that the FBI, or the BI as it was then, had shown during the Red Scare right after World War One, and mm-hmm. then in their approach after World War Two, because to me it looks like a piece of the same cloth, the hounding of Emma Goldman and the attacks on the IWW, mm-hmm. similar to the later Red Scare.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll take his answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. Early socialists there and the Wobblies, Roderick Jeffries Jones. Of course, we've had more than one period of Red Scare in this country, and the FBI very active in each of them. A difference in scale, in kind?
Well, I think Marty raises an interesting issue here. There are similarities, clearly, between the Red Scare of 19 and what happened in the 1950s. But I think I'd like to draw attention here to the pragmatism of J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover was in charge of the Radical Division at the time of the moves against the Wobblies in 1919, and of course in charge of the FBI in the 1950s. Now, Hoover was something of an opportunist and would do things which would advance the interests of his bureau. And in 1919, when Attorney General Palmer was keen to move against the Wobblies in the left and was an aspiring presidential candidate, Hoover went along with that. But Hoover was very astute, and he realized that this anti-red campaign had gone too far in 1919, and he pulled his involvement and the involvement of his radical division in time because public opinion shifted around against the Red Scare. Similarly, in the 1950s, Hoover was without doubt someone who pursued the left with great ardour in the 1950s, but he did fight shy of associating himself too strongly with irresponsible members of Congress who pushed the McCarthyist and HUAC investigations too far. He did have a very healthy respect for the law and for his remit under US law. So we're looking here at, in the case of the FBI, as someone who had very pragmatic, an institution with very pragmatic leadership. Sociologically, of course, if you're looking at society more broadly, one can see parallels between, more closely, one can see parallels between 1919 and the 1950s.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the FBI at 100, from Dillinger, G-Man, and J. Edgar Hoover to the War on Terror. Just to be reminded how out there it was, let's listen to a universal newsreel on anti-Vietnam War demonstrations around the U.S. and abroad. You'll hear at the end here, President Johnson not only didn't deny, he positively trumpeted that the FBI was watching Americans who were against that war.
Anti-war demonstrators protest U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War in mass marches, rallies, and demonstrations. Central Park is the starting point for the parade to the UN building. The estimated 125,000 Manhattan marchers include students, housewives, beatnik poets, doctors, businessmen, teachers, priests, and nuns. A companion peace demonstration brings out 50,000 marchers in downtown San Francisco. President Johnson, meanwhile, let it be known that the FBI is closely watching all anti-war activity.
The FBI is closely watching housewives, beatniks, priests, and nuns there in that newsreel from the Vietnam War period. We've been joined by Professor Roderick Jeffries Jones from the University of Edinburgh, author of The FBI, A History, by Kartha D. Deloach from Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, author of Hoover's FBI, The Inside Story by Hoover's Trusted Lieutenant. You can join us as well. Let's go to Apachu, calling from Lansing, Michigan. Apachu, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. This is mm-hmm. a wonderful program, and I want to thank your guests for coming on. I know it's not easy at times.
We appreciate it, too.
I have
two
questions.
Mm-hmm.
My first question is that as a young man, I'm 58 years old, Malcolm X was and still is a hero of mine. In my readings, I understand that the FBI played a role in his assassination and in the way that they were not only aware, they may have provided intelligence to the black Muslims. That's my first question. My second question is, could your guest please explain the relationship between the Major Crimes Act on the Indian reservations in this country and the enforcement by, my understanding, the FBI agent as the major agent and the FBI agency as a major law enforcement institution. Could he please take care of those questions?
Apache, we'll take a crack at it, and thank you for your call. Karthik Deloach, first to you on Malcolm X. We had a decade of many, too many assassinations there. You hear our caller's suspicion as he's read history about an FBI role there. What do you say, sir?
Which assassination are you referring to, Tom?
Malcolm X.
No, the FBI had no role whatsoever in that. We were greatly surprised at that. Well, I should say we were surprised because there were many militant members of that particular sect, but no, we had no role whatsoever and knew nothing about anything in advance of the murder there.
Jeffries Jones, Roger Jeffries Jones, what about it? There's a pointed question from a caller in your reading of history. How does the FBI come out?
I don't think so, Tom. I think there's no evidence whatsoever that the FBI were involved in the assassination of Malcolm X. I think that this conspiracy theory, which is what it is, tends to arise from the poor relationship between Malcolm X and the FBI. The FBI had tails on Malcolm X and put out a huge number of agent reports on him on the mistaken assumption that he was a threat to American national security. Indeed, a whole book of documents has been published in this case. But the FBI did not go so far as to get involved in an assassination attempt, nor did they, to the best of my knowledge, have a hand in the assassination of anybody in the whole of their history.
And what about when it comes to American Indian reservations? The FBI, there's the famous Wounded Knee incident.
Well, there was the notorious siege in 1973 when the FBI was heavy-handed and a couple of AIM, that is, American Indian Movement militants, were killed. I think this is the case of botched professionalism on the part of the FBI rather than a malevolent attempt to crush the aspirations of Native Americans. But one can understand the feelings that the case engendered because it does stretch back, as you say, all the way to the Battle of Wounded Knee in the 19th century.
Karthik Deloach, I've just got you for another minute. I wonder, with all of your history with the FBI, how you look at the Bureau's situation right now, post 9/11, with a great emphasis on counterterrorism activity. Can the FBI fully take that on and be the crime-busting bureau that we saw for most of the 20th century, stop the bank robbers and the bad mortgage lenders and all the rest?
Well, I think the FBI is still one of the best intelligence and law enforcement agencies in the world, and that's been proven time after time. But may I go back and just take a second to refer to things that Professor Jones said? And incidentally, I think he's done his research well, but there are some factual errors there, and insofar as President Truman feeling that the FBI was too powerful, that wasn't it at all. Why he took the Latin American jurisdiction away from the FBI was simply because of the fact that President Truman felt very ill towards the FBI at times because of a previous feud that he and Mr. Hoover had. When Truman was still in the Senate and was running the Truman Committee, investigating criminal activities and possible internal security activities towards the Pullman Union, Mr. Hoover refused to give him information for our files, and President Truman resented it and went over Mr. Hoover's head to the Attorney General and did get some information, but not nearly as much as he wanted to make the committee look powerful and get additional publicity. Mr. Hoover was not an opportunist. He was a man that sought good publicity, factual publicity for the FBI, because he knew in order to gain public cooperation, he had to get proper attention from journalistic sections in the United States. And so consequently, he did put out press releases concerning our solving of cases, and particularly more important cases, in order to convince the public that we were a good organization and gain their cooperation. You cannot solve cases unless you have the support of the American public, and that was one way of getting it, and I fully approved of it and assisted in it in many ways. There was a difference of opinion concerning the investigation of communism, and it was indicated previously that possibly the FBI lost public relations advantages with the American people as a result of their investigation of communism. The Ku Klux Klan, altogether different from communism. Ku Klux Klan were physically violent. The communists were not physically violent, but they tried to get the attention of the American public in order to gain so much as much support as possible. There were thousands of communists in the United States trying to do that at that particular time. We were worried about the sabotage opportunities or potential of the Communist Party, and we were worried about their attempting to overthrow the government by violence and by force. It showed later on that there was a little opportunity of that, but at the time it was necessary for us to investigate them. Vietnam advocates, the marches towards Washington, the dangers towards them throwing rocks and bricks and at various government buildings, breaking windows and so on. We had to keep abreast of that, not only the directions of the Attorney General, but also the directions of President Johnson, as I indicated. But these things should be taken into consideration. I hope that we were not heavy-handed. We were heavy-handed only when jurisdiction caused us to investigate something quite thoroughly, and it could be considered heavy-handed, but we call it a jurisdictional matter, where we had to bring the facts to the attention of the Attorney General, the President, and sometimes the congressional committees. Mm.
Katha DeLoach, you are a voice right out of the middle of the 20th century there with your perspective, which I appreciate. I get a powerful sense of time travel hearing from there. I'm taken straight back to it and to your 28 years with the FBI before your retirement there in 1970. We're very grateful to you for sharing your thoughts and reminiscences with us today, Mr. DeLoach. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Katha DeLoach, former deputy director of the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover, author of Hoover's FBI. We're joined now from Washington by Eric Lischblau. He covers the Justice Department for the New York Times and has been right in the middle of wiretapping reporting and much more since 9/11. He's author of Bush's War, The Remaking of American Justice. Eric, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
Here we are on a 100th anniversary and really a history that goes farther than that, as Rodri Jeffries-Jones reminds us from Scotland, at a time when the FBI is being focused on a counterterrorism job as priority number one. Can this bureau do that and cover the bases of crime fighting, crime stopping that have been its job for a century and more, Eric?
Well, that's the question a lot of people are still asking now, 7 years out. The FBI, as you indicated, has gone through a remarkable transformation. Half of its agents are now devoted to counterterrorism and national security matters, which is a huge increase over where they were pre 9/11. And that has meant inevitably a short shrift in terms of personnel and resources and priorities for its traditional mission, things like bank robberies and white-collar crime and drugs and gangs and things like that. And it's also a whole shift in mindset. The FBI is being converted very quickly into an intelligence agency, not solving crimes after they've happened, but basically trying to predict them before they happen. It's still an open question how well they'll succeed.
Eric, you've been right at the heart of reporting on wiretapping since 9/11. Now, the National Security Agency, the NSA, has been front and center in that. But what about FISA, wiretapping, and the FBI? Are they an integral part of that story as well, or how do they relate with the NSA effort and the larger wiretapping effort?
Sure. The FBI certainly has a central role in wiretapping of suspects on U.S. soil. And traditionally, since 1978, when the law was changed after Watergate, the FBI goes through a special secret court when it wants to wiretap someone that it believes is involved in terrorism or espionage or other national security matters. What we've now seen the last 2 years since we disclosed the NSA's spying program is that you have a whole other agency involved in the mix here on U.S. soil, and that's the NSA, which has technological capabilities to wiretap that go well beyond anything the FBI can do. Now, the NSA historically had been focused overseas. It was a foreign intelligence collection agency, and what President Bush did in secret orders beginning just weeks after 9/11 was to allow the NSA to target Americans for the first time without going through the court, and that inevitably encroached on the FBI's own authority. You now had this 800-pound gorilla in the room that was also in the domestic intelligence business.
And what about now? Does the FBI have authority equal to that of the NSA in wiretapping today with the latest legislation that's gone through Congress or not?
It does. I mean, certainly the law that just got the president's signature last week affects the FBI, at least in theory, as well as it does the NSA. But on a practical level, technologically, the FBI does not have the ability to use the tools that the NSA does in terms of collecting vast volumes of communications traffic, of phone calls and emails and the like, and sifting through those to see which ones it wants to target. That's not the FBI's role, and it's not what they're capable of. So the law really gives latitude to the NSA in a practical way that it does not to the FBI.
Let's get a call from Boston and Russell. Hi, Russell. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. My question was, I'm fascinating history of the FBI, very impressive, but I'm more interested in the modern issue that was brought up by Jane Mayer in her recent book, The Dark Side, saying,
yes,
you know, if a few people had done their job, 9/11 would have been preventable. And I'm thinking, as a crime-fighting agency, you know, we're a country that grows up watching crime stories. We're all fascinated. We all sort of know the terrain and the legal system from watching all this television. But why didn't that crime really get solved? If a few people had done their job, who are they? Why weren't they fired? I mean, so all this work's been done since 9/11 to make us more secure. But a few people not doing their job, that hasn't even really been addressed. So,
Russell, our time is short. Let us go straight to that. Eric, you know, we've got like 2 minutes, but take one of them. And if you boil it all the way down to the time we've got, how do you answer Russell's question when it comes to the FBI?
Well, certainly the 9/11 Commission looked at that in depth, and it found a number of key episodes where the FBI had fallen down on the job. There were signs in the months prior to 9/11, particularly that summer, of there were signals in San Diego. There were two of the hijackers were living basically in plain sight. In Minneapolis, you had Zacharias Moussaoui, who drew the suspicion of his flight instructors at a flight training school. You know, the FBI itself has acknowledged that it failed to connect the dots, and that there were events that could conceivably have altered the course of 9/11. Another point that the caller raised, no one was disciplined for that. In fact, some congressmen have been upset because some of the players at the FBI actually were promoted and honored after that.
And Roderick Jeffries-Jones in Edinburgh, last word goes to you here, I think, today. What about it? The intelligence challenge that was not met. Where do you put the fundamental explanation on the FBI front, and do you feel that's solved going forward? And you, sir, have 1 minute to answer that.
My first observation is you can't stop them all, no matter how good your system is. Someone's going to get through. The prevention of surprise attacks of that kind is notoriously difficult. I think I would draw attention to one thing, though, in addition to the poor coordination of the counterintelligence community, and that is the continuing ethnic prejudice which led to the non-hiring of Arab Americans as translators. There was a translation backlog, so some of the signals that they did have through the NSA and other sources of an impending attack were not translated in time.
And that thread, as you describe it, one that goes way, way back in FBI history.
It certainly did. I would just qualify this by saying that the FBI is the most progressive agency in the world when it comes to hiring non-white people. The situation in Europe by comparison is quite disgraceful.
But still, enough xenophobia in your view, that it left a kind of a chink in the armor there.
Absolutely.
Fascinating history and a fascinating road ahead. We'll follow it more. I'm so grateful to each of you for being with us this hour. Rhodri Jeffries-Jones, author of The FBI, A History, the University of Edinburgh, thank you very much for being with us today. And Eric Lischblau with the New York Times, covering the Justice Department, their author of Bush's War. Eric, it's great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to you both. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.